WPHM. The WPHM Morning Show continues with guest host Garth Kriwal on 1380 WPHM.
My last guest this morning is Horace Gilgamesh. That is the nom de plume of an author and writer of a series of books called Awkward Moments Children's Bible. Good morning, Horace.
Good morning, Garth. How are you doing?
Hey, how's life out on the West Coast? You're calling us from California?
I'm calling you from the middle of nowhere, kind of north of Bishop, California, out in wildfire territory, yeah.
Oh, well.
The fire is under control now.
Well, that's good news. I have a brother out in San Jose, so I think it's a little ways from him, but they're causing huge problems. So, well, as long as you got a cell tower, you're good.
I do. I got up early, got off the John Muir Trail yesterday to come out and find the cell tower to chat with you. So I'm glad to chat. I'm glad to talk to a good Michigander. I lived across the state there for 10 years while I was in ministry, kind of out along the other lake shore on the big lake. And it's always good to chat.
Well, we're on the shore of Lake Huron, so we prefer to think of that as the big lake. So
I'm sure you do.
The
blue water.
Your books, Awkward Moments, parentheses, not found in your average children's Bible, they look like typical children's books at first glance. The big type, colorful illustrations, and the subject matter is completely biblical. Yet some people don't look kindly upon them.
Well, we should also say the first three words on the back jacket are all caps, not for kids. But yeah, I mean, like you said, it's fully biblical. The idea really came a few years ago, sitting with a number of friends from ministry and PhDs in theology, just frustrated by the reality. At the time, I was a Christian even. The reality that in the U.S., more than 50% of professing Christians can't even name the four Gospels or have the very simplest ideas or understanding of biblical understanding of theology and facts and quizzes and things. And so we got to talking about kind of putting together a book of the more awkward parts of the Bible that you're not going to hear spoken from the pews and you're not going to find in your daily reading journals that are supplied by the Christian bookstores. And the way to do that was to kind of cross over, not into so much parody or satire, but like you said, just using biblical verses combined with kind of awkward illustrations to bring up the facts and the ideas that people haven't really thought about, maybe for the first time since they were children, as they kind of keep the Christianity in their back pocket rather than their front pocket.
Well, I have to admit, you know, the story of Noah and the Ark, and the children's version is the animals marching two by two and on the Ark, and the rains come, and that's that. But in fact, the world was destroyed by a worldwide flood. Everybody died except one family.
Wouldn't it be great to have the kind of privilege to be the one family or descendants of that family who have not been destroyed by the flood?
Well, we all are descendants of that one family, apparently.
So, exactly. How convenient. Storytelling.
Well, it's, you do hear people say, well, it's in the Bible. But I've found with people is often it's what they understand about the Bible is what they've been told and what has been interpreted by other people.
Sure. Well, do you happen to have that one of those books right there with you, Garth?
No, I don't have a book with me.
Well, but, for instance, like in the Noah story, sorry to interrupt you there.
No.
The idea being that, yeah, sure, the kids' version, and everybody thinks of it as the cute, colorful animals marching two by two, and everybody's saved, and the floodwaters recede, and there's a rainbow and a dove, and everything is great. But most people, most adults, have never actually even read the story of Noah's Ark, and they don't get to the part where God very strongly says, I wish I'd never made any of these people in the first place. And when you think of the heavenly, holy, meek and mild in those terms, suddenly much more of the Bible makes a lot more sense, including much of the life of Jesus Christ.
You know, it's interesting the impact that religion has had, certainly, and the omnipresence of it in society. Do you think humans are hardwired in some way, not towards any particular religion, but toward spirituality?
It's a good question. I do think that humans are hardwired, and there's more and more science to show how hardwired we are to look for sequences or find meaning or patterns in random events. And so if you put that, if you juxtapose that with prehistoric times or kind of more naive native times of there's an earthquake or there's a flood or there's a rainbow, it has to be because of narcissistic something I did, me, or because something our tribe did, or because we won against another warring tribe, or frankly, you know, there's a drought or some kind of natural disaster. And, well, if you can't understand why it's happening from a scientific perspective, I'm not to get into the science versus religion
right.
ideologies, but when there's still more ignorance in the world at that time than there is understanding, you do start looking to the skies to wonder, well, why me? And as those ideologies or ideas are supplanted with, you know, mythology, those mythologies continue to grow and get adapted. And that's why every new incarnation of a religion has the marks of the previous religions on them. And, you know, we're in the waning days of that nowadays with progress.
Right.
And being able to understand more and more in the world. But, yeah, I think people like to look up. You know, I just spent the last 2.5-3 months out in the trails in Yosemite and north of the fires there in the High Sierra. And it's pretty easy to sit on the edge of a cliff and look out across the Milky Way and think, well, there's got to be something bigger than me.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that there is, but it sure means that we all feel small at times, and we all want to feel that there's something out there that's bigger than us, that's guiding us and protecting us. And
right. Well, you see that anytime you see a disaster and, you know, multiple people are killed and somebody survives it, and it's a miracle. Well, you know, what about the other people? You know, what about the ones that didn't survive? You know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other people of that, you know, that's part of the problem of suffering in the Bible, you know, even the story of Job. But in that same disaster you'd speak of, there would be people of certain religious persuasions that would claim, well, those people who did die deserved it because they were out of step with God, or because the gays get to marry. You know what I mean?
Right.
You've heard all sides of that. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, we all want to look up, and I think a lot of it also comes down to just the angel and the devil on our shoulder of a lot of times we don't want to take responsibility for our own actions personally. So isn't it great that there's a scapegoat known as Satan that we can blame? Mm-hmm. Or when we're scared, isn't it great that there's somebody watching over us to, you know, pick us up and carry us if that's needed? It's a great story.
Right. Well, there's certainly an argument that all morality comes from being part of a system where there's a higher authority. And I guess by extension from that there's no morality without belief in a greater power. Are you a moral person?
I'd say that's one of the greatest emancipations I was ever able to go through over the last 8 to 10 years, was to come to the conclusion that it's okay to be good without God. In the same way that if you take a look back throughout history, and, you know, even the most conservative estimates put humans in their current form back at about 100,000 years. Some people would say 200,000 years. And it wasn't until 4,000 years ago that God decided to intervene to save people from all the horrible forms of death and dismemberment and disease, to find this little part in the Middle East to get involved and bestow upon Moses these 10 commandments that nobody had ever thought of before, that it wasn't okay to kill and steal and lie. To me, that's offensive to the human race. The idea, and I think it would be true even back in the early times of the earliest Gentiles looking at this Jewish tribe that's now warring with other tribes and claiming that they have the answers and the keys to the kingdom, and that they're more moral because they have God on their side. Well, everybody has God on their side.
Mm-hmm.
Allahu Akbar sounds offensive when it comes from a Muslim overseas, but then you see our own congressman yelling, "God is great" and "God bless America" from the stage. And it's the exact same methodology or ideology, just in reverse. And so I think if you're going to choose a spirituality or a moral compass from an organized religion, you have to be careful, because there's a lot of organized religions out there that claim the exact same thing. So to get away from that is to recognize, I think, what we all have in common and what we all share, which is our humanity. And as we go forward in history, and as our humanity and our progressive secular values continue to force religion into the fold of that progress, you know, well, I think we're all better for it. I think you're seeing that, especially even with the current pope, the Catholic Church and the Vatican. Every new pope becomes more and more, quote, liberal, and puts more doxology to rest.
Yeah.
It used to be seen as the word of God. It is suddenly no longer the word of God, because a man in a dress said so. I mean, I say that jokingly, but yeah, I think, well, I guess that's my answer. I don't need to blather on for long.
Well, it you know, things evolve, and people as much as they would not like things to change, the fact is that I once told a conservative friend of mine, and she's a lovely young lady, and I said, and very conservative, and I said, I guarantee you that I have no idea what you wear to the beach. I guarantee you that what you wear to the beach, whatever it is, would be scandalous 100 years ago. And, you know, things change and you don't even notice them. And
sure,
it's happened so much. You were a minister, and now, instead of kind of spreading the word, you're trying to do things that are more tangible for people, in the sense of food and water and helping the needy. What are some of the on your little road to Damascus? I think you talk about that moment when a child came up to you and said, "Do you have food? Do you have water? That's what I need." What was that moment like?
You refer to that as a road to Damascus. I mean, I think what I've found for everyone in my circle of friends and family who has walked away from religion, there hasn't really been a road to Damascus moment. I mean, that's written in the back of one of my books, that I had a aha moment. I think it was in Nigeria at the time, where we were out there distributing Bibles and trying to get villagers to come to a big gospel presentation with, you know, tents and videos, screens everywhere. And so we were out there recruiting, if you will, and a boy walked out of the woods and was asking for water. And I had no water, because I was there not to meet the most immediate needs of my fellow man, my fellow human, but to raise funds, frankly, for a Christian ministry back in the U.S. by dollars for souls, counting off conversions at the end of the night on a note card. And for me, that was definitely a turning point. But the actual, and that was more of a turning point for ministry, in my ministry and kind of professional life, realizing, you know, we're not really meeting the most basic needs. And then, empty stomachs have no ears, was a phrase a missionary from another country had told me on that trip, and it stuck with me ever since. And so I'm more trying to make sure that humans, whether it's using faith-based initiatives or not, are meeting the most basic needs of their fellow man.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, as far as personally walking away from the faith, I think, just like all my friends and family have done the same over the years, it's much more of a drip, drip, drip event. You know, there aren't atheist big tent revivals with lights and sirens and fog machines and screaming rock bands and an altar call at the end to get everybody up crying in front of their friends and peer pressure and group dynamics to get them to convert away from Christianity. It just doesn't happen. So usually it's much more of a drip, drip, drip process and pulling band-aids off painfully one by one. It's not easy. It takes a lot more courage, if you will, to come out in a Christian nation, for all intents and purposes, and say, "Yeah, I'm okay. I don't believe. I'm good without God." And I still don't do that. And there's a reason I write under a pen name. There's a reason most of my family doesn't even know that pen name, because we are still, for all intents and purposes, there's a lot of privilege that comes with claiming the religion of the throne, so to speak.
Well, the you still, you know, you grew up, a part of your professional career certainly was within the ministry. You still have friends who are in the ministry.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I just spent about 140 miles on the trail with a pastor out of the Seattle area. I have a lot of friends who are in ministry. I do have a few friends who have rooted me out, and they haven't outed me publicly, but I have lost a number of friends in the past few years who were even around that round table when we came up with the idea for the Awkward Bible illustrated books.
Yeah, but, it's. I don't think it's unbiblical to ask questions about anything, and that's what... My background is newspaper. I ask questions and I try to understand things or put things in perspective. That doesn't necessarily mean I agree with something or disagree with something, but asking questions to have a better understanding, for me is never wrong.
And I think when it comes to labels, I was very hesitant to accept the label of being an atheist or an agnostic or even a Christian for that matter. But a couple of years ago, a pastor, a well-known megachurch pastor from Texas, wrote me a fairly nasty letter calling me a mother effing heretic. And I wrote back and I said, you know what, that's actually probably the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me when you understand the original Greek roots of the word heretic, herikos, which means simply one who is able to choose, one who is able to look at both sides of a discussion and make a rational choice based on the facts of the day. And you can see why the idea of being a heretic was just terrifying back, and even still today, why that was so problematic to the religious leaders of the day, is to have someone who is able to still make a choice on their own. That's exactly against the will of trying to, I use the word lightly, but bring in more of a cult mentality of the marriage of church and state. And I'm talking back 2,000 years ago, but the same certainly exists today.
Well, my guest is Horace Gilgamesh. If you Google his name, you'll come up with Awkward Moments Children's Bible. You'll also come across his blog. Horace, the reason I asked you on here today is, again, I think we talk about various religions quite frequently, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, whatever. But it's like this dark secret that some people don't believe. And let's talk about that too. How does someone convert to Judaism? How does someone walk away from organized religion? What your books and blogs do, I think, more than anything is make people ponder. And that's always a good thing. I appreciate you taking a few minutes from the wildfires of Northern California to talk with us this morning.
Hey, I appreciate the opportunity. You guys enjoy the rest of your summer out there on the Big Lake.
Well, you too. Thank you very much. Horace Gilgamesh. Thanks.